Well, get ready for this Coast to Coast ride. We're going live to England as we talk about the spiritual meaning of the 60s. We'll talk a little bit about Aleister Crowley as well and some of the things he did next with Tobias Turton next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Tobias Turton is a world authority on Gnosticism, Freemasonry, the Rosicrucians, appointed honorary fellow of Exeter University in 2005. He holds a master's degree in theology. He's the author of many books, including Aleister Crowley in America and The Cult Paris. He lives in the heart of England, where we are going live now on Coast to Coast. Tobias, welcome to the program. Is there a Tobias? Nope, I do not hear Tobias. So we will check again. Tobias, are you with us? All right, that's an interesting little trick there. As we went live to England with no Tobias, folks, if he has disappeared on us, we're going to end up with open lines, aren't we? And if we are, let me give you the phone numbers just to be on the safe side. Here we go, west of the Rockies, 800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 800-825-5033. First-time caller, 818-501-4721, and the wild card line, 818-501-4109. We're going to go until we find out if we get Tobias back or not. We're going to go with open lines. We're checking to see where he is right now. He was on the line, but somehow disappeared. Those calls from England sometimes just drop out, and they're gone. And so be it. So let's go to some of the calls to get things going. And I'm going to go screen them, unscreen calls like the old days. Welcome to the program. Who are you and where are you?
Well, I'm Bob, and I'm in Tahoe City, California.
Well, welcome to the show, Bob. What's going on? What's on your mind?
Well, I got a solution to the barrier between California and Mexico.
Well, tell us, because somebody needs a good solution.
Okay. Now, I'm a little bit crazy, but if we built a 2,000-mile energy source with pipes with fluid that can be heated up to steam under pressure, that can run steam generators, that can run industrial communities, joint ventures between Mexico and America, and give Richard C. Bloom a cost-plus contract to design and build the energy source in the industrial community, with an open-end cost, the immigrants could be employed on the project until they can enter the USA legally. And on eminent domain, if you drilled an oil well on the property that you want for eminent domain and give the owner of the property a cut of the oil, production of the oil, and use the other finance security on the border, Richard C. Bloom is Dianne Feinstein's husband.
Well, you're not insane, Bob. It's not a bad idea. And, you know, I would guess it would be better than spending that kind of money to build a border wall. They tell me that Tobias Turton is back on the line. Tobias, are you there?
I'm there, George.
There you go. I had this great introduction for you, and we couldn't find you. You disappeared.
Something in the air.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. What time is it in England right now?
In England, it is 8:13 in the morning.
There it is. Well, here I'm in the Midwest. It's 2 o'clock in the morning here. It's just turned midnight on the West Coast, and it's in the wee hours on the East Coast. So welcome to us. I'm going to talk with you about your latest work, The Spiritual Meaning of the 60s. We'll also get into the Aleister Crowley story as well. But this is an amazing book, and it may be one of the biggest books in terms of size and thickness I've ever seen. How long did it take you to compile this?
Well, I'd say a lifetime, in the sense that the book was first lived before it was written, growing up in the 60s and all that. But in actual writing time, I can only stand the intensity for about 6 months. So I wrote it in 6 months in a sort of white heat of enthusiasm and interest.
Indeed.
And, it was like getting it off my chest, as it were.
What was it about the 60s that captured your attention?
Everything about the 60s was interesting to me, because I was born in 1960, I was born deaf. I couldn't hear until I was three.
Oh, my God.
It was called a birth defect. And so the first thing I remember hearing, other than echoey voices, was the Beatles singing Please Please Me. And I felt that I actually felt as a child that I'd been born into an immensely special time. And I'm sure that's true of children in any era. But the 60s seemed to have it all. It was moving so fast. And every time you looked outwards, there was something new in the air. Either it was another space rocket going up, or there was a new kind of push button, or the television was getting more exciting, or the music was heating up. So it was a great cauldron of positive energy, tremendous positive energy, the like of which I missed it so much. When we sort of slipped into the 70s, I remember this tremendous feeling of loss. You know, where's it all gone?
What was it about the 60s in England that really popped the culture? Because, you know, here in the States, we had Elvis Presley emerging, and we had the Beach Boys, but the Beatles took the world by storm. Then came the Rolling Stones. How did this happen?
Well, there's so many factors are involved. It was all cooking. It was all sort of under wraps in the 50s and then started to come out. There's no doubt at all that the advent of the Beatles was the catalyst. You have all these factors emerging, a new generation, a large number of young people, an impatience with existing authority and structures. And then you put into that this magical component, the Beatles, who seem to have inspiration, energy, newness, a fabulously haunting image for people, and were both divisive and also uniting. They united some people and divided others. They were part of what set the era aside. I think we were also receiving so many indications from the United States at the time. I remember the day Kennedy was assassinated myself. I remember my mother crying. Now, this was in England. There was a sense that something was about to be born and had been snuffed out. And then it got relit again, and it was quite extraordinary.
It truly was.
It was thanks to Kennedy. In 1961, he declared America's ambition to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. And I think that this made it decade conscious. The 60s was an entity. By the end of the decade, you had a defined period of time. And what was the direction of this decade? We were going up. We were going out, literally out of sight. These rockets were going into regions that previously people thought were inhabited by spiritual creatures and angels and the God's domain, and we were going there. So that thrust, that magical breakthrough, which people had only imagined in a psychological or in a fictional sense before, suddenly became real. So we were introduced to a new reality. And it was this incoming of new realities that I think characterizes the era. And if you were open to it, and this is the important factor, if there was an openness to it, you could bathe in this extraordinary energy. I mean, obviously, this isn't all that was going on, but this was the center of what was going on in the great laboratory of the planet.
Well, it was a great, powerful moment in the history of this planet. We seem to have a goal in a direction. We seem to be a little rudderless now, Tobias. Do you get that feeling?
Very much so, yes. I think there's been a massive loss of confidence and energy over the years, and new thoughts and things have suffered great repression. The opportunities have been there. The collapse of the Soviet Union, for example, China of Mao Zedong opening its doors to some extent. There have been opportunities, but these have been treated very much, in my view of things, in a very opportunistic way, not in a spiritual way at all. I think it's all become very realpolitik and checks and balances and accountancy and money and many of the sort of negative aspects of human fear and insecurity are being regenerated. So we're all supposed to be scared of somebody else, you know. And you can't come out of your cave if you think the tribe outside's going to bash your head in, you know. If you look on the tribe outside the cave as, well, they're pretty much like us, you just might be able to meet in no man's land. So the 60s have a great deal to tell us about the nature of creative engagement and also the cost of that, because the 60s wasn't only for a few people, it was like a prolonged party, But I say in the book that the two pillars of the 60s were hope and tragedy. And it was in the tension between this hope and this tragedy that the great drama was played out. And in that drama, it's overflowing, as I found, the more I examined it objectively with the hindsight, with spiritual meaning. It is saying something to us. It's in a way, you could say, we've not only got to have faith in the future, but we've got to have faith in the past as well. A lot of 60s denial came in the 1980s, Bonfire of the Vanities period. The 60s was a waste of time. It didn't really do anything. We better shore up our, get our acorns in for the eternal winter that is to come. And there was an enormous self-obsession which has took over the mentalities of the Western world. Whereas the 60s had both individual development and a care for those around. It was a spirit of generosity was much more in evidence then. So I think we have lost our spiritual rudder, and we have this nihilism today. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that when people stop believing, or you have leaders who don't really believe in anything beyond their ego universe, as it were, I think you have what I call the politics of despair. And there are always people who are prepared to pick up on despair, and usually with an aggressive cudgel, and take what appears to be a lead. I think of the 1930s, where in Germany particularly, where the economy was even worse than it was in the Great Crash in America and Great Britain, the Depression. Is it an accident that when you get depression, you get dictatorship? There's a temptation.
It could be.
Bond together in uniform, and these are spiritually negative tendencies. If you live from a spiritual dimension in life, life is full of opportunities, and today is as beautiful as it was in the 60s or any other time.
But it doesn't seem that way.
We are to the era we're living in, and I think we're less alive to our own times.
Are these the 60s? Would you say were the best of times and the worst of times?
I think it all depended where you were. For me personally, it was no doubt the best of times. It was a marvelous time to be a child. If you had very interesting family, which I did, even though my parents were very conservative, they were also excited about the future and their part in it and that of their children. I think if you've got hope, you're going to have the best of times. If you give up hope, you're going to see the worst. They always go together, these two aspects of life. And you've got to be able to live in the face of the other dimension. You've got to accept that half of life is always going to be what you don't want or appears to be threatening. And, as they say, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. You have to bring into this earth your experience of the heavenly. So you can't get out of it by denying the harsh realities of natural life in this life, but we have spiritual and every other means to deal with these things.
Well, here in the United States, we went through, as you mentioned, the tragedy of the Kennedy assassination in 63. Then his brother dies in 68. Martin Luther King gets gunned down, and then we turn the table in 69 and land on the moon. In that euphoria seems to come back again, but the 60s were rough times. We had the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. I think had it not been for music, Tobias, a lot of people would have gone crazy.
Oh, I'm absolutely sure you're right. I mean, what is so incredible, and you're talking about, we take so many things for granted. I mean, my publisher told me some years ago that he was beaten up in New York City for having long hair in the early to mid-60s.
Yeah, I believe that.
So people who stood out against the tide of growing war in the Far East at that time were taking real risks, so they weren't having a party in that sense. A lot of people took the knocks, and I'm not sure how much we appreciate what they've given to us in terms of expanding the possibilities of liberty. So, of course, you're right. It was an apocalyptic period. There was much greater fear then of nuclear holocausts It was far more realistic because the Russian, the Soviet Empire of that period really did look like a great gray monolith that was going to fall on us. That was the sort of feeling about it. And yet at the same time, you had this, people didn't just cower up and wrap themselves into a ball. You had this young generation which says, well, we don't want to go in this direction. We want a different kind of world. And while that was a tiny minority, I do believe that the greatest changes in human history are always the result of a committed, and I don't necessarily mean that politically, I mean a spiritually committed minority who have belief and faith in the future. And, you know, people say, well, where's the leadership? Where's the leadership? Well, the whole thing, as I recall Bob Dylan's song, was don't follow leaders, watch the parking meters. We've got to take a greater individual responsibility for our lives. And so in the 80s, you did have this freeing up in the capitalist dimension of things where people were encouraged to have their own businesses, especially in England. This was quite a novel idea. Don't be dependent on the state and so forth. Well, that's fine. If we're not going to be dependent on the state, then the state can no longer be dependent on us. So you have... Anyway, the other thing about the 60s really is that it didn't end.
It kept going.
Yes, I think it's a play that keeps running. I mean, why did I write this book? It was my daughter. She was about 16, and I found she was buying vinyl albums by the Rolling Stones,
uh-huh. Beatles,
and Bob Dylan, and the Byrds. And I said, well, where's this coming from? Because, okay, I'm playing occasionally some of that music. But for her, it wasn't following Daddy at all. She cottoned on to the idea that there was something she'd missed. And even though the version of the 60s that was coming to her is a kind of TV media version that's been cobbled up where everyone's supposed to be high, Woodstock is permanent, everyone's having psychedelic experiences, even though that's a false image, very, very untrue to the multifarious facts of the era, what's interesting is that got through to her in a way that, say, I, when I was a child in the 60s, didn't dream about the 1920s. Normally, new generations are very quick to forget the past. They don't really want to hear about it. But here is one decade, which is now, you know, 50 years ago and more, that is appealing to a intelligent 16, 17-year-old person. What is it? That's what... And I asked her. I said, would you like me to write about this? Would you like to... She said, Daddy, it's one book you could write that I will read.
I love it. And they did it all without smartphones, Tobias. They did it all without smartphones.
Without smartphones, without the internet. It was the kind of spiritual internet. You sent a record, you put a record out, and that was heard on the radio, and the radio was the air of change.
Yeah.
That provided the oxygen of this change. I think radio in the 60s was enormously important.
It sure was.
The airwaves were buzzing, and it was a real risk, as you'll remember, to put out some of this music. And in England, the government tried to stop the free radio stations. There was one called Radio Luxembourg. People used to tune into it at night, and it was run from a boat out in the North Sea. But that little radio station, all the DJs who ran it became BBC DJs. The BBC
right.
had to buy in this renegade spirit and bring it in, and, of course, bring it to heel to a certain extent.
They became superstars, didn't they?
They became superstars, for better or worse. Yes.
Stay indeed. With us, Tobias. Hold on for a second. We're going to take a break, but we will be back with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Tobias Churton, and his book is called The Spiritual Meaning of the 60s. Tobias, tell us about that title, The Spiritual Meaning of the 60s. There's a reason you picked that.
Yes, because the book is what it says on the tin, as we say here. I like difficult questions, and it seemed to me that if I was going to write about the 60s, we don't need another history of the 60s, there's lots about. What the real question, as I understood it, was what is the spiritual meaning of the 60s? It's easy question to ask, but very, very difficult to come up with an answer in one line or something, and that's so that I wanted to engage with that question and find all the different ways in which it could be answered, because, in fact, there are many, many spiritual meanings to the 60s. And in the words of St. Paul, spiritual things are spiritually discerned. So they're not all obvious things. You have to get the light of inspiration shone on a thing, and then you see the inside. You begin to see the inside of it. And I was looking for the inside of the 60s. What was the essential spiritual motivation beyond the politics, beyond the surface? And that's what I was looking for, and I was looking for it in every aspect I could think of the period, in the politics, in the religion, in education, in psychology, in pop music, in art, visual art, sculpture. I was looking for it in orchestral music, in jazz music. I was looking for it in the civil rights movement. I'm looking for it in acting, theater, you name it. I went digging.
How important was music in changing the mood of the 60s?
I think music, as you said, changing the mood, I think it was reflecting the mood. Mm-hmm. And where the Beatles were concerned, they were always about a couple of steps ahead of the game. I think, as John Lennon said, it wasn't that the Beatles caused what was going on, but he said he felt they were in the crow's nest and could look a little bit further because of the extraordinary position that they held and their very great willingness to act as the megaphones of a generation and to reflect what was going on. And in reflecting all the different things that were happening that many people weren't noticing or weren't encouraged to notice, spiritual changes, changes in ideas, attitudes to religion, and so on. In doing that, of course, it changes the mood. But when you change the mood, you get a reaction. And, of course, the 60s is characterized as much by reaction as by action. And so, yes, you were talking about the assassinations, and assassination is always intended to invoke fear. It reflects a fear that people have, and that gets focused on usually disturbed individuals. But it is the effect is to cause a fear, to close people down. And when you go on an adventure as extraordinary, as pioneering as was undertaken by some people in the 60s, there's going to be a struggle. And that struggle was very real. I was just thinking while we had the break, I heard an advert about cyber threats.
Yeah.
Back in the 60s, the word cyber was for the cybernauts in the Avengers TV series or in Doctor Who, which was a science fiction British series. The cyber men were kind of evil creatures who had no heart and no conscience and just smashed their way into everything. And here we are in 2019 talking about cyber threats as a normal thing that we must protect ourselves from. And that made me think that I think if there was a kind of prophetic spirit going in a lot of the creative work in the 60s, it was far-sighted, that was seeing new dangers that were going to come. And this idea of the cyber threat, again, we're projecting a fear and abusing opportunities. The internet, of course, like television, like radio, music, is the greatest opportunity to bring the inner life into the outer world. It's a river of hope, but the fear creates the perversion of it. So you asked about the music. The music's important. Not all the music of the 60s was great or anything. It's just that the best of it has come through, and the Cream was very rich indeed and very, very beautiful and still stands all these years later and will go on standing because sure. It was pure inspiration.
Well, one of the great things it did, the music in the 60s, is I think it uplifted the younger people who really didn't have a voice prior to that because, you know, you look back at all the television shows in the United States, Tobias, most of the actors and actresses were older people.
The Donna Reed Show, yes.
You know, and stuff like that.
Mom and Dad, and the whole nuclear family of the period was an image. It was sold on television, and I suspect that people actually living it were finding it very tense and very difficult to live up to this 1950s clean-cut image. Pleasantville, I think the film, mm-hmm. movie Pleasantville captured that everything orderly but spiritually dead. This needed waking up, yes.
It uplifted the younger people, which I think was healthy for this country and probably England as well. And now it may be the other way around. I think now, you know, a lot of advertisers want to, you know, select their campaigns toward a very younger crowd. Everything seems to be that way. The music is so much different than the 60s. I mean, it's truly remarkable how things have changed so much. Do we go in cycles, do you think?
Yes, but the cycles may be a lot bigger than we imagined. You know, there are sort of epicycles. There are small cycles of public fashion, which do a kind of small circles. So fashioning clothes will come back at certain regular intervals. Fashionable attitudes will recur. The 60s, certain aspects of the 60s have been sold back to the people in the media and through fashion and attitudes television. Every so often there's a kind of a frisson of 60s nostalgia, which you can sell. And I think a lot of people's conception of the 60s is often, especially younger people, is an image that they're being sold. That's why I wrote the book, because I wanted the young people of today and tomorrow to know a much deeper, a much more real image, truth about the 60s that the image obscures. And that's really why I did the book, because I wanted that to be out there and to be available for people who truly wanted to know.
And you've said the 60s really haven't ended. Explain that a little bit more.
Well, I think of things like, I remember Christmas 1968 watching the television when Apollo 8 went round the dark side of the moon, and the astronaut gave a reading. If I remember right, it was from the book of Genesis.
Yes, it was great.
It was an amazing moment, and it was the first time that we had this notion of the Earth not only being seen from outer space, we'd had that in the early 60s, but from behind, as it were, the moon, as a slightly remote thing, as almost out of touch, but still there and beautiful. And this new objectification, this regarding the Earth as a whole object, as a living being, is one of these legacies of the 60s that is not going to go away. And I think Earth awareness is positive, one of the very, very major aspects of the 60s which we have to live with and we should want to live with. We suddenly became aware of the beauty of the Earth in a way that was new to us, but also the fact that there are no borders on this globe. When you see the truth of it from a higher perspective, there are no borders. You don't even see cities. You may see the odd light, but what the Earth really is became visible. Now, that affected the whole attitude to the green issue, environment, the realization that we've got a small skin of fresh air between us and death, oblivion, a vacuum, the vacuum of space. Infinite space may be very inspiring, but you want to live in it is another matter. We are living in space thanks to the nature of the Earth, not thanks to politicians.
Now that's true.
Not thanks to the banks. We're not living here thanks to the media or to superstars or to Hollywood or anything like that. We're living here because the Earth supports and sustains life, and it's that life we grapple with. And the 60s gave an intense awareness of that, which affected some people. It started to manifest politically, particularly in Germany, parts of California in the 1970s, and it continues to grow. And so we hear things like, act locally, think globally. And that global awareness is a real fruit of the 1960s beginning of a spiritual revolution. The 60s was only a beginning. I do think that's got to be said. It wasn't a complete. It's as an era we can look at it as a whole, but of course it's part of the continuum. Seeds were planted, and the seed contains the future in it. So also, I think this idea that a young person has integrity and should be respected and has a mind and a voice and a soul and a spirit and may think differently to the parents or the so-called authority figures, that it's okay to question authority. But, you know, you've got to find yourself. This whole idea of know thyself comes from the ancient world. It's not a new thing. Cogite ipsum, gnosi se auton, as the Greeks would say, know thyself, the message at Delphi. This idea that you, in order to understand the world, you must first understand yourself. I think this is tremendously important and was trumpeted in the 60s by the few who could see it. Talking about, you know, who was really turned on or switched on in the 60s is interesting, because one of the things I wanted in the book was to give the voice of people who were not part of the party. There's an amazing scene in a film called Midnight Cowboy, made in 1969 with John Voight.
John Voight and Dustin Hoffman. Great movie.
Wonderful movie and Oscar-winning. But there's an incredible scene. It's set in 69, which, again, people might think Woodstock. But here's these two guys, really down on their luck, living, I don't think they've ever had any luck, living in a tenement on virtually no food or what they can grab. And they're invited to a party like the Andy Warhol factory. And to get there, they have to have, they're given a pass, which is handed to them by a couple of supermodels, as we call them now. And they go up the stairs in this place in Greenwich Village. The door opens, and blimey, there's the 60s. You know, it's bubbles on the wall and people smoking dope and women in incredibly futuristic clothing. And Dustin Hoffman, who's basically wants to be a pimp but can't quite get it together, you know, he thinks, what's all this free love? That's not going to make us any money. And he sort of walks out. And in a way, the 60s was an invitational thing. You were either in that party, in which case you'd have been aware of certain things more than people outside. And what people outside the party, the streets were just as cold as they'd been in 1941, and poverty was just as miserable as it's ever been.
Yep.
And the world was as difficult to grapple with as it's ever been. So we have to beware of the illusion of the 60s, which was evident even during the period itself. All that futurism, a lot of it was quite misguided. I mean, I think of the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. Well, in that movie, which is an extraordinary technical achievement of the highest caliber, they thought we'd be going to Jupiter in, you know, 18 years ago. Now, clearly, something either has gone wrong, either the prediction was completely bad, or we've seriously lost our way.
We probably could have had we continued pushing with the manned space program, and we just slowed that down.
Yes, I think the politics of the era and the disenchantment came in. And I don't think that disenchantment was accidental. I mean, I think the 60s was kind of beaten up.
Well, what's amazing, Tobias, too, is when you look at the 60s, in another year, we basically are going into our 60th year since the 60s decade started. Can you believe that 60 years ago?
I know.
I mean, it's almost more than half a century.
Well, I had a very vivid sense of this year because I was my family were immigrants in Australia from England. We went to Australia in 1966 with $100 and no job and nowhere to live. And we made the flight. We arrived. Dad was laboring on Queensland Railways. And we eventually caught a Greyhound bus down to Melbourne. Where mum found us a rented flat in the red light district of Melbourne called St Kilda in those days. And we went on and had 2 years in Australia in the middle of the 60s. Now, I went back this year, 50 years later, to the places we'd lived in then. And by God, that was a shock. And it was sad because my family have all died now. So I missed them. And but what I really missed, of course, was that indefinable 60s.
Yeah,
it's gone. What's left is to my mind a sad thing. And yet I could see it. I could see how it was. The imagination and the youthful spirit came alive in me again. And I don't feel 50 or 60 years.
It gave us great memories.
I'm 58 now, and I don't think I'm as old as my dad was when he was 58. So
our parents seemed older at a younger age, didn't they?
Yes, because I think they had so much taken away from them early on, you know. And
I mean, my father retired from his employment when he was 60. 60 today is young.
Yes, it can be, can't it? Yeah, I think that That is very much apropos of what I'm saying with the book about the spiritual meaning. The 60s is the first flowering, I think, of what you could call the child archetype, or in Aleister Crowley's vision of things from 1904, the Aeon of Horus, the young god, who's got his little finger on his mouth because he's really a child. Is we have in the 60s the manifestation of child psychology writ large, with all the positive and the negative. You've got the unrestrained reconnaissance, you've got the innocence, you've got the desire and will to explore, you've got the reaching out, the capacity to love and to cherish, and of course you've also got the destructive throw things out of the pram, smash it up, don't like that, rebelliousness as well. So you've really got this in spades in the 60s. And today we are you do feel that the old men are sort of shuffling back and telling us all what we ought to be doing and all the rest of it. So yes, I think the young people in the Western world are rather confused.
Yes, they are. Stay with us, Tobias. We'll talk more about this. I also want to chat about your Aleister Crowley book, and we'll take phone calls with you when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.